Hello, boys and girls, and welcome back to episode number 3 of the Get Fit podcast series. I'm your host, Andy Gallardo, Director of Fitness for Kaiser Permanente, Southern California, coming to you from the City of Roses, sunny Pasadena, California. In this episode, we are excited to bring to you our very own Dr. Sean Hashmi, the Regional Physician Lead for the Kaiser Permanente Adult Weight Management Program. Sean is also the Assistant Area Medical Director for the Woodland Hills Medical Center, and he is going to share with us a scientific approach to healthy living. Gonna be great stuff. Of course, a couple of quick disclaimers. This information is not intended to replace your healthcare professional. I am not a doctor, nor do I play one on TV. Always consult your physician before exercising. Opinions on this show do not represent the views of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Kaiser Foundation Hospitals, or the Southern California Permanente Medical Group. We do not receive compensation for any products or services mentioned, nor do we endorse any products. The full disclaimer can be found on our website. And with that, welcome back and let's get to the show. All right, welcome back to the Get Fit podcast series, episode number 3. So we have a whopping 3 episodes in the bank. And this one is really exciting for me because we get to talk about food. And who doesn't like talking about food? And we are lucky to have the world famous Dr. Sean Hashmi from Woodland Hills. He doesn't like for me to call him an expert, but I'm going to do it anyway. He is the Regional Physician Lead of Adult Weight Management, as well as the Assistant Area Medical Director for Woodland Hills. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm excited to be here, and I'm glad I'm number 3. Awesome.
So, yeah, you get the first 2 that maybe had a little glitches in there, and we get to move on to number 3. But this is why I'm so excited to talk to you, because every time I talk to somebody about food, they say, well, what are you? I'm like, what am I? What do you mean? They're like, well, are you pescatarian, flexitarian? Do you do paleo? Do you do this? Do you that? I'm like, I don't do anything. I just eat food. Why has this gotten so hard?
You know, the real reason why food is so challenging is because we don't have those gold standard studies that we do in other things. So take cancer research. You can do randomized placebo-controlled trials. So what does that mean? So basically, I don't know what's going on in the study. You don't know what's going on in the study. And I give you a pill that may or may not be a sugar pill. So that allows us to really know if the medicine is working. But in food, I can't do blinding. That's really hard to do. And the other thing I can't do is I don't have enough money to be able to do a long-term study to find out what works and doesn't work. This is why common things like debates over what's the best diet, should I take a multivitamin, how should I exercise with interval training, should I not, is there really all these things? The reason there's so much confusion is because people can create confusion. You know, all you have to do is say something very controversial. As soon as you say it and it goes against the norm. So common thing in our field is this, somebody will come out and say, Western doctors don't know any nutrition. This is something I hear all about it in every single person that I read about. There's a lot of gurus on the internet who say, well, in medical school, they don't get any training. Therefore, they don't know how to counsel you. But I know the secret pill that I can tell you. If you only eat broccoli all day long, you're going to do great. And the truth of the matter is we haven't found what the best diet is. And we probably never will, because the amount of time it takes to find that out, you and I will probably be dead.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge. But in the meanwhile, instead of giving the stuff that's sound and that's evidence-based, people want to hear stuff that sounds sexy, exciting, that sells books.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily the truth. So the stuff that I preach is not the kind of stuff that makes headlines. And it's not the kind of stuff that people want to, you know, make you into a New York Times bestseller, because the problem with the stuff I say is based on evidence, and it states what the limitations are. There's a lot of stuff we don't know.
Right. So let me set the stage a little bit as to why I called you an expert, okay? And I think, you know, you being a physician and me being kind of a wellness ambassador, we were kind of facing similar questions in that people would hear all sorts of crazy stuff about crazy diets, and they would say, well, what does Kaiser Permanente promote or endorse or believe in? And we were like really struggling with that answer. So the reason I call you an expert is you really took a look at all of the research and basically went into a cave for like a month and really dived into this. So I really wanted to kind of, you know, talk about some of the things you uncovered and kind of work through that. So let's start with, for example, just kind of randomly, the low carb diet, you know, good or bad, what'd you find out?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So I came into the regional role about 2 years ago. And so the first question that was asked of me was, we need a stance for Southern California Kaiser Permanente. What diet are you going to recommend?
Yeah.
And that was very interesting. And I honestly did not have an answer. So I hid literally in the corner. I reviewed initially 600 studies to come up with our initial statement on what we were going to promote. Then I gave it to our evidence-based team. They reviewed it and they got back to us and said, we agree with you. And what you're saying is also consistent with what's out there in the national guidelines. So that was really reassuring. Since that time, I've continued to just constantly update the PowerPoint that we have. So now it's over 1,500 studies that I've looked at, and every week I continue to update stuff. So what I found was very interesting. First, any diet works. And on the low-carb diets, it's very interesting. Low-carbs can be divided into a couple of different arms. So you have the high-protein arm and you have the high-fat arm. Now, the high-fat arm is really interesting because people go by different terms, but keto is a popular term for it. And in the keto literature, it's very interesting. You know, keto diets have been used since the late 1800s, and they were initially used in children who had epilepsy. In fact, it can be very beneficial in people, including children, where the most data is, in children who have refractory seizures, or in children as a first line for helping them out with seizures. So there's a lot of evidence that low carb can be beneficial for certain conditions. Now, when you talk about diseases and sort of markers for diseases are things like A1C, which is a measure of your sugars in the blood, or things like cholesterol. And what we find about A1Cs, cholesterols, and all of these things is if you look at studies that are less than 6 months, the results are beautiful. Low carbs actually outperform all the other diets. And this makes them very, very appealing. In fact, a lot of shows on TV that are trying to make people lose weight really fast, they emphasize very low carb, very high protein. And the problem is those same shows, if you look at the data 6 years later, as one study did, you find that unfortunately, they have gained all the weight back. In fact, if you were to look at it more than a year out, they start to gain all the way back. So the problem with diets and low carbs is in long-term 12-month and more studies, there is no difference between those diets versus if you were following a Mediterranean, if you were a pescatarian, a flexitarian, and so forth. The study that we do know is that if you're looking at overall cultures, well, cultures versus diets is very different because the way a Mediterranean diet is performed in the Mediterranean region is different than how we perform Mediterranean diets in the Western culture. So the word diet is a very big misnomer. You have to look at it from a cultural perspective. For example, if you look at low-carb diets and you're somebody who's smoking 2 packs a day, it doesn't matter which diet you do. You could staple your mouth shut. You're still going to die of a heart attack.
Yeah.
People forget the basics and they say the diet is going to cure it. So the answer on low carb, the literature says beyond 6 months, the difference is not there between that diet versus other diets.
And just, you know, to add a funny commentary to that, the people I come across that are practicing some form of low carb or even no carb tend to be very cranky. And you know, for me, I'm like, man, what's the point? If you're in such a bad mood all the time, is this diet really worth it? And like you said, after 6 months, they tend to fall back
right
to where they were before. So
now people use extremes, right? So the low-carb people, when they talk about it, they use the extreme and say, well, you know, the typical person is eating so many carbohydrates, this and that. The problem we run into is the first thing is that typical Western diet, people have more sugar for breakfast than most people in other countries of the world have their entire day. In fact, the typical American breakfast, you might as well have straight ice cream because literally most people have more than 50 grams of sugar in their breakfast. This is the typical average breakfast. And if you look at the guidelines for how much added sugar we should have, if you were eating 2,000 calories a day, you should have less than 10%, which is less than 50 grams per day. Most people have that for breakfast. But the guidelines are have that completely for the entire day. And 50 is your max for 2,000 calories a day. Now, if you're getting 1,600 or 1,800 or 1,400, that's a lot less. So people eat such bad food that if they make a conscious choice to do a diet, that by itself eliminates a lot of the bad food. So whenever I meet somebody who does low carb, paleo, anything, I don't care what it is, plant-based,
yeah,
I congratulate them because they have taken such an important step
right
on becoming conscious of all of the bad stuff out there. The first step is you've got to become aware of all of the bad things you're doing. So any diet for that fact, if it allows you to do that, that's a step in the right direction.
So you bring up an interesting point. I think one of the other things that I'm coming across a lot is you bump into people that are on something, paleo, gluten-free, and it's really working for them. So they think that's the answer, and they really try to get you into their diet, you know, because it's worked so well for them. But the reality is like you said, everybody's a little different. They're going to have to make different choices. What do you do when you come across those people that are just like, you know, we're dealing with it now with plant-based diet. Everybody seems to be on that, and everybody wants you to be on it, you know.
So the first part of the diet theory is, you know, diets have become the new religion. And this becomes really important. In fact, there's a diagnosis called orthorexia nervosa. And what orthorexia nervosa is...
doesn't sound good.
No, it's not. You start freaking out about diets so much, about eating clean or eating healthy, right, that you don't eat anything. There are girls, teenage girls, who are now obsessing about this topic of clean eating so much that they're actually becoming malnourished, which is a scary concept in itself. You know, there are so many gurus out there who are now talking about things like, well, you have to only eat this type of rice versus this type of rice because of the arsenic. And if you're going to eat this type of rice, you have to cook it a certain way, wash off the extra water that's on top just so that you don't get arsenic. That's paranoia. Right. To me, that's complete and utter BS. Because what you have literally done is confuse the heck out of people. You know, as a whole, what we find is if your diet is mostly plant-based, you are doing the healthiest thing for your body. The difference that I have with some people is people go to the extreme and they say, if you are not 100% vegan, then you are wrong. And that's where my discrepancy is, because I can't state that if you were vegetarian versus you were vegan, that you were somehow a bad person. People always cite studies like the Adventist II Health Study and say, well, the Adventist II Health Study said that the vegan diet was the best. The answer to that is no. The Adventist II Health Study said that depending on what marker you are looking at, all-cause mortality, death from strokes and heart disease, if you were looking at diabetes, you either had pesco vegetarian or you had vegan or you had something else such as flexitarian, that was the best. There wasn't a single best study. In fact, we just did a literature search to say what is the best diet for diabetes, and we couldn't find what was the best diet. So if you're looking at all the things combined, a diet that's mostly plants is excellent for you. So our healthy plate model in healthy balance classes is 75% plant-based. 50% is non-starchy vegetables, 25% of the plate is starchy vegetables, then what's left is 25% protein. And people are mad on both sides. They say, well, you know what, I want more protein. The data doesn't support that. Others say, we want plant-based protein, just switch it for beans. I love beans. I think if you had to pick one food that is the most powerful food in the world, it's beans. They're incredible for you. But anytime you take any diet, whether it's plant-based or anything, and say that is religion. You know, one of the criticisms of me that I always get is they say, why aren't you telling people that we can reverse diabetes? I have issues with that. Whenever we start to make claims we can't back up, if your pancreas is destroyed, If I cut off your finger, it's not growing back. If you tell a person you got cancer because you didn't follow X diet, I have an issue with that. You know, I got into this field because my wife has lupus, my mother has colon cancer. This is very real to me. This is not something that's so far away. I take it very seriously. My mother never smoked. She came from an area where trying to buy meat was incredibly expensive. Our whole life was based around plants and vegetables. That's what she did. She still got colon cancer. You have to be very careful in the statements as a physician that we are making. We have an obligation to this. So whenever somebody comes to me and they want to pass their religion on to me, I listen to them and I congratulate them for taking the step to make an active choice in their health. And that's where the conversation ends. But what I want to make perfectly clear is there's a difference whenever somebody treats anything as a dogma, as this has to be the case, then we should be a little bit worried on every aspect. Because once you start thinking the earth is flat and you don't want to listen to anything else, we know how that story turned out.
Yeah. And I think we're also probably susceptible to the media in trends and feeling like if we're not a part of this trend, something's wrong with us. You know, I think it's probably been, you know, 2 years or so now since like everything was gluten-free and it just exploded, right? You know, are we done with that gluten-free thing? And, you know, if I've heard this correctly is really gluten-free is designed for people with celiac disease, which is really only 1% of the entire population. So why did people feel like they had to go that direction?
Because part of this has to do with whenever we have companies who have an incentive to make money, it makes it very difficult. Now, when it comes to agriculture and food politics, it also becomes very difficult. So the argument from the people who favor the gluten-free diets, they say is, look, if you look at the history of wheat, it's very interesting. We have breeded wheat purposely so that we could make it resistant. And in order to make wheat resistant, we wanted to make sure that we could make the wheat stalk bigger. But if you make the stalk bigger, the actual wheat component, then the stalk, if it's too long, it falls over, it breaks. So what did we need? We needed dwarf wheat, right? We needed a really short stalk with the wheat on top. And we needed to make sure that it was designed to be able to be resistant to things like pesticide because we had this world hunger. So all of that stuff got done without transparency. Whenever there isn't transparency in anything, it allows for a lot of people to say, hey, there must be something. There must be aliens. There must be something going on. So it's a conspiracy theory. You can't prove it and you can't disprove it. So now it makes it very difficult. So they argue, they say, well, the time that those changes in wheat and the crop structure was happening is also the time that we see the obesity crisis rising. But that's the same argument where we look at the papers from the 70s government administration, which was opting for things like artificial sweeteners. We look at those transcripts and we say, oh my God, you know, these guys knew that here comes the lobbying industry people asking to make sure that we are pushing artificial sweeteners. So that created a whole void. When we start to look at things like what happened with the low-fat craze, well, we never went low-fat as a society. This is a really interesting concept. So people say that the doctors and the health organizations were promoting a low-fat diet. So we religiously followed a low-fat diet, and guess what happened? We all gained weight and stuff happened. So what happened was when companies looked at low-fat, the problem was if you take fat out of food, it does not taste good. People don't buy it. People buy stuff because it tastes good. People have addiction to certain things. It's salt, sugar, and fat. So as they lowered the fat, they found out if we add sugar, we can actually get people to the same bliss point, which is the point of maximal pleasure from food. And not only that, they found out ways to manipulate fat and manipulate sugar and manipulate salt. So the second the food hits your mouth, it would all be released at the same time. And you would have this euphoric effect, which is what food does. And that's why certain sweets taste so darn good. So overall, the portion sizes increase. So if I had, I'm making this number up, but if I had 10 grams per serving, and now I have a bigger serving size, so even though I lowered the fat, on a concentration basis, but I just make you eat more of it.
Yeah.
Did you really lower the fat, or did I just make you eat more fat? You ate more fat. And not only that, because I lowered the fat to make it taste good, I added salt and sugar. So now we did three bad things. We added fat, we added salt, and we added sugar, and we made the portion sizes larger.
Right.
So all of a sudden, people gained a lot of weight. Now, with the gluten-free craze, the problem with gluten-free is the argument is this. The percentage of people with gluten disease, what we call the prevalence of gluten disease, hasn't changed. 1% of the population has celiac disease. Then there are these gray zones where there are people who may have partial celiac disease. They don't know it. And they may benefit from being gluten-free. The problem is that's still an extremely small portion. But right now, you know, there are certain books out there that argue all wheat is incredibly bad for you. It's linked to schizophrenia. It's linked to dementia. It's not the wheat that people hundreds of years ago ate. In fact, it's not the wheat that we ate 50 years ago because it's been modified so much.
Modified, right.
Nobody knows. But here's what we do know. If that was the case, then the incidence of those kind of diseases, mental health disorders, schizophrenia, should be skyrocketing because wheat is so-called linked to that. But there's no data. So everybody wants to say, well, you know what? I'm an expert because I wrote a book. And if I write a book, and I right now write a book and argue that the world is flat and somehow make this crazy argument, and you believe me, I will have a bestseller on my list. Once people do that and they fall for that, diets like gluten-free diets become very, very popular. Now, when people do gluten-free on the old days, what was happening was if you cut out wheat, unfortunately, wheat is in just about every product. So when you cut out wheat, what did you really cut out? Calories. So people who did either low-carb or gluten-free or any one of these diets, if you looked at their total calories, they went down significantly. Significantly. So all of a sudden, they're not eating that much. So which one was it? Was it because they cut down the calories? Or was it because it's the actual wheat? So head-to-head studies show what? There was no difference. So now what do you say? This is why when people go on gluten-free, I say, well, congratulations, because one, you're trying to get rid of all of the processed stuff like French fries and potato chips and all that. Great. The rest of it, that's up to you. If you like it and you're doing well and that's working for you, great. But is that something that I'm going to promote and preach? No, because the evidence doesn't support it. And if tomorrow the evidence comes out and says, Sean, you were wrong about that, gluten-free is the best thing, I will come on here and say, I'm sorry. This is what the evidence shows. My job is very simple, is to be evidence-based, not opinion-based. So it's not my job to come up with my own opinion or what I do personally, which is a whole different, everybody wants to know, how do I eat? What diet camp do I fall in?
Yeah, that happens a lot.
All the time.
So, yeah, and you know, I think the other thing with gluten-free and a lot of these diets is they make them really hard. You know, I was overhearing a conversation with a colleague the other day, and this person was registering for a conference, and she called the person running the conference and wanted to talk about the meals. And she was going through all the things she needed. You know, she needed a gluten-free pasta. She needed a sauce with no sugar. She needed no dairy. She needed no this. She needed no that. And I could just hear the person on the other end going, oh my gosh, this person is really, you know, really demanding and really crazy. And I don't think this person had any medical reason to make all of these demands. And so this was just one meal. And it took like 10 minutes for this conversation. And so, you know, my fear is not only are we jumping into these crazy fads, but, you know, it's taking up a lot of time and money for things the evidence doesn't really support.
And what does the average person do when you're saying one thing, I'm saying another, and the third guy is saying another? They feel like they're being tossed around. So this is why people have fatigue. There's something called diet fatigue that's starting to sit in.
Very real.
People are tired. People are tired of hearing so many people talk about what is the ideal way to live. Well, how do you know? You're going to die of something. We're all going to die. I mean, I get a kick out of this that, you know, people say how not to die. You're going to die.
Right, right.
I want to know how to live. I want to live to be a better person. I want to stop criticizing people. I want to stop judging people. You know, we talk about racism. We are so quick to make decisions about people because they don't agree with us. We need to open ourselves to other ideas. That's how we grow. If you can't open yourself and your diet camp is so closed that you won't listen to any ideas and you're willing to bash anybody who comes along and says even the smallest thing that's different, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, for me, my wife and I, we don't eat meat. That's just the way we are. That's not because we're religious. That's not because of any other reasons. We find that we are the healthiest that way. But if somebody says, well, you're plant-based, I'm not any based. I'm not any diet camp whatsoever.
Isn't it funny that you have to be something?
Yep.
You know what I mean? That you have to have a label for some reason. And I think that's, you know, what I mentioned in the very beginning is driving me nuts that you don't eat meat. This just doesn't have to be a thing. It's just how you live your life.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's really interesting for the month of July, I stopped drinking. Just stopped drinking. I wanted to see how I felt and how I reacted. And I noticed that in social situations, it made people a little uncomfortable that were drinking next to me. And I'm like, it's okay. You know, it's no big deal. But I noticed them start to cut down on their consumption. And I didn't mean to have that effect. So do you find that with meat? Like, do people get kind of weird around you if they're eating meat and you're not?
I'm in a very tough position because I give talks all over the country now. And as a result of it, I can't have lunch anywhere. Everybody wants to look at it.
Yes,
they critique every little detail of it. And it's kind of funny, but at the same time, it's kind of tough because I say, look, you don't have to do what I do. You have to look at the evidence. I give you the evidence. I break it down in very simple English. And then you can decide the pieces. You know, we know that just making three or four simple changes that we'll mention at the end of the show are all you need to do to get 80% of the benefit. 80% of the benefit. Yet people are arguing about the 90 other changes you have to do to just get this little tiny additional benefit that at the end of the day might not even matter.
Right.
I'm all about what do you have to do today? Go home so you can get the best return on investment, so you can spend some quality time with your family and have a fulfilling life. There's no point in being on such a strict diet if you're so focused on the diet that you never get out to do anything else. There's no point to it. The world is beautiful, but it could be ugly if you want to make it ugly. You want it to be beautiful, then you got to act that way. So we do these things to ourselves, but then we become so closed. You know, it's an interesting thing when you look at the blue zones. I love those books that talk about the blue zones because what they teach us is that these cultures that don't have any 24-hour fitness, that don't have LA Fitness, I want to be fair, so I'll mention some few gyms. You know, this way nobody feels bad. Equinox, there you go. Okay, so I feel better. But they don't have any gyms. They don't have any vitamin shops or vitamin stores or GNCs there. And what they do is their diet is mostly plants. They look at meat as a celebration because, frankly, it's too darn expensive. So they eat it a couple times a month. They walk on average 5 to 10 miles a day, and they sleep on average 7 to 9 hours. There, you're done. That's literally all they do. And then the last component, which I think is an incredibly important component, they have an awesome social structure. So instead of their elderly going to nursing homes, their elderly stay with the kids. They have purpose. In fact, when there's family gatherings, it's actually seen as very honorable for the elderly to cook. They like to cook because they feel like it gives them purpose. They like to go and work in the fields. They're 100 years old and they're going and working 8 hours in the field. Why? It gives them purpose. For us, we live in this amazing country that's full of opportunities, but when we look at our people who are getting older, we think they can't do anything. That's not true. They still can. The brain is there. The body is there. You have to treat that. You have to build those social networks. So for me, I preach self, sleep, exercise, love, and food. Food by itself is not the answer. Diet is not the answer. If you're not sleeping, that's a huge thing. If you're not exercising, that's a huge thing. And love is so important. If you don't have people in your life that you're creating relationships, spending time with, and having genuine conversations with, you're missing out on a key component to healthy living. You know, diet is just this ugly, ugly word that the first three letters are die. Plus a T.
Right.
And I don't want to die plus a T. I don't want another diet. I want to know how to live in a balanced lifestyle where I finally figure out how can I be happy in this crazy world where we're so busy on jumping from one thing to another like rabbits. But how can we slow down? How can we enjoy this world? And self is about that. And the idea of self I actually got from looking at places like Okinawa, Japan, places like Loma Linda in the Seventh-day Adventists. When I looked at these cultures, it was fascinating, the five current blue zones and how they live. You know, we introduced...
So take a quick sec to explain a blue zone for people that don't know.
So blue zones are the five areas in the world that have the largest living populations over 100. The centenarian populations there share certain very common things, which is sleep, exercise, love, and food. That's what they have. So those five areas are places like Icaria, Greece, Okinawa, Japan, Sardinia, Italy, Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, and of course, Loma Linda, California. Those are the five identified areas. There's others too. But what's unique about them is the simplistic things they do as part of their life. And they have the largest living populations. Overall, lowest rates of heart disease, diabetes. In Okinawa, Japan, you know, McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chickens recently started popping up. And what happened to their mortality? Shot right up. Because what we did was we changed it. And people said, well, what if it's genetics? It's very interesting. When people come from Okinawa, Japan to America, what happens to them?
We ruin them.
We ruin them.
Yeah.
That's how interesting it is. So I find it interesting that people talk about genetics and they genetics is a part, but genetics is only a framework. You need an environmental trigger to make those things come to life. Even cancer, you can have the genes and never have expression of those genes. Environment plays a huge role. And right now for us, our environment is terrible. So if somebody says, I want to do a plant-based diet because it's great for the environment, I agree. In fact, the best diet in the world for the environment is a whole foods diet because the impact on the environment from livestock and cattle is enormous. 20% of the United States methane generation comes from livestock. If you went...
So when you say whole foods diet, what is that?
Right.
Is that whole foods meaning plants or... The different categories of foods.
So whole foods would include plants. It would include grains.
Grains,
plants.
Okay.
So yes. So pretty much if you're looking at just the whole foods category, it's non-animal based products.
Gotcha.
And the impact is if you're a vegetarian, if all of us became vegetarians, we would lower greenhouse gas emissions by 65% in the United States. If all of us became vegan, we would lower greenhouse gas emissions by 70%. That's how big of an impact you can have on the environment. Livestock, cattle have a huge impact, huge carbon footprint. But what about if you went a little bit? Would that help? Absolutely. So nowhere does it say that if you don't go 100%, you are an evil person. But what it says is the more you make choices, the more it tells the manufacturers that's what you like. So if you opt more and more for red meat, then manufacturers feel they have to raise more cattle, produce more. Same thing goes for anything, whether it's dairy, milk, eggs, doesn't matter. Whatever you opt for, you're telling the market. If you opt for, I want more organic foods, industries develop to deliver more organic foods. There's more regulations around it. And guess what happens to the overall price? It starts to come lower. This is how you drive markets. It's every single day when you buy something, you're making an active decision to support or not support some idea. But at the same time, nothing in here should be religion.
Right.
Where you say, oh my God, I have to be 100% this. And if I ever deviate, I'm just a bad person. And there are people who say, look, I love animals. I would never harm an animal. How wonderful is that? I applaud you for believing that and doing that. Whatever your beliefs are, that's fantastic, but we have to be open-minded to everybody.
Yeah, you know, and I think another really hard thing that I experienced recently is, you know, the irony of a lot of like kids' sports, for example, is there's a lot of picnics and barbecues and a lot of things at stadiums. Most of the food there is hamburgers and hot dogs. And so, you know, we were recently at a kids' sports picnic and they only had hamburgers and I was starving, so I got a hamburger. But the hamburger I got wasn't cooked very well, so I ended up tossing it. And then I learned, you know, a little bit later through like a documentary or something, like it took like 20 gallons of water to make that hamburger. Then I just felt horrible for not only taking it, but not even eating it. And it really changed, you know, my perspective. And, you know, I think the hard part we're facing now is it's just so easy. It's so easy to go buy a pack of 50 frozen patties and throw them on a grill. You know, hot dogs are really inexpensive and can feed a lot of people. You know, how do we try to like incorporate more whole foods, so to speak, into these big kind of societal things, you know, and can it be done, do you think?
You know, first is, how do you incorporate things? The best way to do it is through these really big influencers that I call. Influencers on a more macro scale are organizations. They are the Kaiser Permanentes of the world. They are the Googles, the Apples of the world.
Right.
You have to start those changes, and you have to start a change and a culture of tolerance with changes that are readily doable. So you can't say all of a sudden, you know what, starting today, we're going to have absolutely no meat whatsoever, and if you're caught, I'm going to fine you $10.
Right, right.
That's the greatest way to turn people off. And once you turn off somebody and you make it seem like you're forcing them, they dig their heels into the ground and they fight back. And they get stronger and stronger in fighting back. And even if they don't think the idea is that crazy and they agree with the idea, they will argue with you just because they don't want you to win the argument. So starting at organization's level is really important. If you want to target the children, you must target the parents. You have to. Inner city community. So I went to high school at Martin Luther King High School. This was in Watts in Compton. It was right across the street from King Drew Hospital. And it was very interesting. When I would go out for lunch, we didn't have a single place where you could get anything healthy. And I usually had about 50 cents. So my best place to go was Taco Bell.
Yeah.
I could always go to Taco Bell. Those places, you have to teach people how to eat better on a budget. This fancy stuff of you got to eat organic and you can only have this really crazy, you know, brown rice that comes from this remote part of Africa. I'm totally making it up, but this remote part where it's going to be absolutely pure. That's complete nonsense. If I get you to stay on your budget and eat healthier, I've done my job. Even if you're going to pick junk food and the store only has junk food, if I can get you to make better choices on junk food, I've done your job. So a lot of this is for us as physicians and as healthcare providers, getting out into the communities. You can't build it and wait for them to come to you. We need to get out there. We can't let these, you know, charlatans out there go into the grocery stores and scare the living daylights out of people.
Right.
We need to be the ones taking people on a tour. We should be out there in the inner city community saying, I'm going to take you on a grocery store tour. That's going to show you not only can you stay in your budget, because I'm going to do the shopping with you and show you how you can stay healthy and get you food that's tasty and delicious. Wow. You know, I have tried so many different types of food in so many groups that I know for a fact you can have healthy food that's delicious and you can save money on it. But we need to cut this facade of it has to be organic or it has to be this. Because the truth of the matter is, the way the agriculture stuff works like now is a lot of the organic farms are right next to the regular farms, and you don't think pesticides goes with the wind? The regulations aren't as strict, and the data has not been there to show there's any mortality benefit. So if that means that your argument is if you don't eat organic, don't eat vegetables, I disagree with you. I just want you to eat more vegetables.
Yeah.
Not 100%.
Yeah.
But eat more plants. Not 100%.
That's a big thing right now that everybody's stopping me. You know, should I eat organic? I'm like, if you have access to it and the price is good,
yep,
then yeah. But should it stop you from regular? Absolutely not. And we kind of are going through that a little bit with fish.
Yeah.
You know, people are like, oh, you have to worry about mercury and farm raised and this and that. I'm like, well, are you avoiding fish altogether because of that? No, just do your best. You know, try to make a good choice. But, you know, again, that kind of goes back to some of the craziness you and I are talking about, that if it's not this, then don't do it. And the reality is there would be very little you could eat if we followed every single little theory and notion and, you know, falseness out there. But a couple things that I think we haven't really talked about is it's just really easy right now to make bad choices. You know, you talked about being a kid in high school and Taco Bell, and that still exists to this day. I mean, it is hard to get in many places fresh whole food, but it's easy to get 5 tacos for a dollar, you know what I mean? Or 3 hamburgers for a dollar, or an entire combo meal, you know, for $5. And, you know, the choices aren't necessarily that great. But I think one of the great things we're doing is, you know, promoting farmers markets, promoting some of the home delivery systems that you can get from the local farms. And we have great local farms in Southern California. I mean, if you're not partaking in some of their offerings, you're really missing out. And, you know, the other thing we talked a lot about kids, you know, getting our kids involved. Tell them to go pick a fruit and vegetable at the store. Tell them they got to cook a fruit and vegetable, you know, one night a week. Hey, you're in charge of dinner Thursday. You know, how awesome would that be to get them involved? And I think they would be a little more successful in adding more plants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. These are the little things in life that make such a big difference. And kids, look, when you're a kid, your parents are your heroes. And it's a while before you realize that Superman and all these other guys become your hero. But your parents are your heroes for a long time, and you imitate what they do. So if you want to be a good role model, do that. Get your kids involved early. You know, for me, is a lot of the talks I give, I take my daughter with me and I take my wife with me, and I talk to them about it, and I want them to know, hey, I gave this lecture, and I introduce them to people, because it's important that they learn now, they get involved now.
Yeah, and you know, I talked about this on an earlier podcast. I think one of my biggest pet peeves right now is we're still doing this thing where there's kids' food and then there's your food. And let's face it, the kids' food is just horrific. It's the mac and cheese, the pizza. It's the kids' menu, you know? And so people always ask me, you know, because my kids eat very well, and it's because I treated them like little adults. There was no separation. You know, and there's a funny joke in our neighborhood when other kids come over for dinner is, you know, a lot of them will not eat what we're serving, and their parents will joke with them, oh, don't worry, when we go home, we'll fix you something. And you just have to smile and be kind and whatnot, but they're doing their kids a tremendous disservice by, you know, don't take the fresh fruits and vegetables and the fish, we're going to go home and make you some mac and cheese. You know, and I don't know, you know, how to get parents to really think about what they're doing, other than, you know, the pediatricians that we work with are starting to share that with a lot of their kids. And a lot of them use price. You know, well, kids' menus cheap. I'm like, hey, man, you only get one kid. You know, why would you skimp on price?
Yep.
You know, so a lot of craziness out there. So,
well, you know, it's so crazy is some of the latest studies show that even when a woman is pregnant, what she eats actually defines the child's future. And that's such a scary concept, that if you are eating bad food, you're predisposing the kid to develop heart disease, to develop high blood pressure, to develop diabetes later on in life. That's how early it starts. So, you know, there are women who ask me, they say, well, you know, I'm pregnant, so it's okay. It's the pregnancy weight that I'm gaining, 40, 50 pounds. No. That is not a good weight, and you shouldn't be proud that your baby came out 14 pounds. So these are things that somehow they've become okay to accept. You know, I had two stories recently in the news that I read about where we've broken records at the largest child being born. There's nothing like good about that.
Right.
That poor child has a lifetime of illnesses he or she has to deal with now. And that's not something to say, wow, you know what, I'm so proud that I got this huge child. No. I need to make sure that I make the right choices from now on. What's done is done. No blame. Let's move on and make the right choices. This is really scary what we do to children. You know, people don't realize is if you want to be successful at something, there are three things that make you successful at any task. The first you need is willpower. Willpower is enough to get you started because it's a muscle. The more you use it, it gets fatigued and then it's gone. So if I have willpower to resist chocolate cake, I resist it and I say, oh, Andy, I'm not going to eat this. But then I leave and another buddy gives me a cookie. I'm tired and I resist it. So I'm like, you know what? I did so good with Andy. Let me have that cookie. So willpower fades, but willpower is needed to get you started. That's the January 1st effect in gyms. Then you need habits. Habits, if you make it into a habit, you will stick to it. But just having habits is not enough. Willpower gets you started, habits keep you going, and skill power is what allows you to be successful. And skill power is knowing what habits to do, is knowing the right tools, the right knowledge. So if you have willpower, you have habits, and you have skill power.
I like that term.
It works.
Skill power.
It's an amazing concept. Just three steps, and it allows you to be successful at anything you want to do. But people mistakenly think that just because I'm motivated because I heard somebody really enthusiastic talk, so now I'm going to go make all these changes. I'm going to run 30 miles today. And then the next day, they're so sore they can't move. And that's the end of the last time they ever exercise.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, we talked about that with Dr. Nanda, just going from, you know, couch potato to something extreme. And, you know, people, unfortunately, because of all the TV shows and whatnot, think that everything has to be big.
Right.
If you know, these small changes don't matter.
You know, there's a lot of, like, people take any idea that you say and they twist it. But now there's alkaline water, which is complete waste of time. But the concept came from, if you ate more vegetables and you had kidney disease, your kidneys would last longer. So they figured, oh, well, you don't have to eat more vegetables. I'm just going to give you alkaline water. Forget about your stomach pH and all that stuff, neutralizing the water. I'm just going to give you all this alkaline water. It makes absolutely no sense. But eating vegetables, which go through, get digested, but they're still enter into the small intestine, get absorbed, and has these remarkable benefits of maintaining your ideal pH. And what it does is it actually shows that animal-based protein actually is harmful for kidneys. Plant-based protein is actually helpful for kidneys. So if you want to preserve your kidney function longer, have some more plant-based proteins. In general, we have way more protein than we need. In fact, the way it works is there's this estimated average requirements, or EAR. So once you have your EAR, to make sure that we cover all Americans, we add a couple standard deviations to that. And at that limit, we come to about 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. But people don't look at kilograms. If you're an athlete, you probably need a little bit more. But most Americans get way more than that. Most Americans get 80 to 100 grams of protein a day. In fact, almost every single meal, we have a significant portion of it as protein. The data does not support that. That's why our healthy plate, 25% of the plate, a quarter of the plate, is the protein portion. And that is plenty for you to be successful and be an athlete. And some great sources of proteins are things like beans, are things like tofu. You know, people are so scared of soy, especially men are. There's no data to say that soy is going to be bad for men. So this is where a lot of these misnomers come in. In fact, even for children, soy has benefits. You know, all the studies that we have seen so far, we don't have studies showing that if you took soy, you were going to do bad as a child. The data isn't there.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's just a whole other area where, you know, it's almost like we cut out the sugar, we cut out the fat. It's like, well, how do we replace all that with more protein?
Right. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, getting back to, you know, making all of these, I wouldn't say bad decisions, but tough decisions, because they're not always, you're not always surrounded by healthy food. And I think the other big thing that's happening is, when you do make a decision to follow something and try something, is that oftentimes those around you are the ones making it hard for you. You know, I talked to a really nice woman the other day that said, you know, I'm trying so hard, but my husband doesn't support me. My kids don't support me. My family gets together every Sunday. And I kind of just said, well, look, you stick to your guns. Eventually they're going to either accept it or they're going to come around themselves. Do you think that's pretty good advice? You know, because what's the option to give in? And you know what I mean?
Right. You know, life is all about negotiation. So everything has to be negotiated. That's how I always look at it. If your family isn't doing what you want them to do, you can't you know, families are interesting, right? We have a different personality when we're at home. So we're a lot more open and we are quick to go from 0 to 60 miles an hour in a conversation and say, no, I can't believe you're not doing this. You know, I had a patient just yesterday, and a wonderful patient. I absolutely love her to death. And her daughter just throughout the whole thing just kept badgering as to why she's not doing X, Y, and Z. And finally I stopped her. I said, listen, she's been this way for 80 years. You're not going to get her to now drop everything, leave everything she knows, and become this completely different person because you're asking. It doesn't work that way. And I asked her, I said, okay, so this is what your daughter's asking. Let me ask you, if you could make one change today of what she's asking, let's compromise, just for me, what would you do? And so we made one change. And it was a simple change, but I knew because once you start with one small seed, you have made it. So a lot of times it's about discovering what is the thing that you can get to that common ground on. You're not going to get them to change right away. But let's agree on one thing. If you're eating 10 hamburgers and I'm strictly plant-based, can I get you to eat 5?
Yeah.
Can I get you to eat 9? This is a great starting point. People forget the power. You know, there's one expert out there who always says that if you don't change completely, you're a bad person, because would you tell somebody, hey, I only want one of my foot cut off or the other? Yeah, that statement sounds really good, but the reality of it is if you look at the mechanism of change and if you study psychology and psychiatry and you look at how does change evolves slowly. You have to convince people that it's their idea. They have to be ready for that change. If they're not ready, how many patients do we have that give you the nod? Yes, I'm going to do it. But you know they're never going to do it. They're just being polite.
Glossed over, yeah.
That's literally it.
Yeah. So, okay, so before we wrap up, one more quote-unquote trend, intermittent fasting. Everybody's talking about fasting now. Personally, the thought of it scares me because I'm one of those people that gets really like the Snickers commercial. Like I get hungry and I get angry. The thought of not eating really doesn't sound good to me. Why is it such a topic of discussion right now?
So intermittent fasting is a big term that has several definitions. So the way you look at intermittent fasting, first of all, fasting is a part of almost every culture that exists. The part of almost every single religion that exists. So fasting is not something new. But here's where it becomes very interesting. There are several forms of fasting that are popular. There's the 5 and 2, which is you eat normally for 5 days, you fast for 2 days. So on those 2 days, you might have 300 or 400 calories or even 500 calories, and that's it, what you have for the whole day.
So you need some calories every day, right? Or does some fasting involve...
So some of the guys, they don't need anything for those 2 days. So that's the 5 and 2.
Okay.
Then there's the alternate day fasting, where they basically eat normally for 1 day, and then the second day, they go on this extreme fast.
Wow.
And that's variable on who does what. I mean, no matter what, you're still going to need water. And then there's what's known as TRF, which is time-restricted feeding. TRF is even though called intermittent fasting, but it gets the same blame. So here's what the data shows. The data shows head-to-head when you compare alternate-day fasting to just calorie restriction, there is no difference. Alternate-day fasting versus calorie restriction, no difference, except alternate-day fasting has higher dropouts. Now, if you look at, you know, whether it's 5 and 2 or alternate, doesn't matter. But if you look at TRF, TRF is a very different thing. Now, people abuse TRF like crazy, but the way to do it is basically you're shortening the window in which you eat. So a typical person may start having food at 8 a.m. They might not finish eating till like 10 o'clock at night. So they have this huge window, and they might actually have their biggest meal before they go to bed. So there's a few studies that are interesting. First is the data shows that if you have big breakfast, medium lunch, small dinner versus big dinner, medium lunch, small breakfast, big breakfast people lose twice the weight, have better sugar control, and have twice the waist circumference difference versus those guys who have a big dinner. So how...
Which is most of America right now,
exactly.
Right? Kind of skipping breakfast or very light breakfast,
right.
So-so lunch, and then pretty big dinner because
pretty big
they're
dinner.
Starving.
Correct.
You know, right.
So now, if you flip that around, we have good data to say that it's good for you. big breakfast, small lunch, small rest,
makes
dinner.
Perfect sense. Yeah.
If you shorten the window of your eating, there's a process known as autophagy, which is a fancy way of saying basically your cells degrade the debris and everything else in your body. There's some very elegant studies. Now, these are not human studies. These are only mice studies and so forth. But what it shows is that if you actually restrict your window of eating in animals, you actually have better autophagy and you actually have better markers. So what are those markers? There are markers of inflammation. There are markers of sugars. There are markers of lipids. So all you're literally doing is lowering it. So how would you lower that? So instead of doing this crazy thing of eating from 8 to 8, maybe stop eating at 6 o'clock. That's it. That's also intermittent fasting.
Okay.
It falls under the same term.
Okay.
But it's not really the same.
Right.
It's a sensible approach where all you literally did was instead of eating all day long and doing nothing else, you just cut it back a little bit. Now, the data on that actually is positive. So if you're looking for an approach that you can do, it's very simple, is look, just don't go eating like till 10 o'clock at night. You know, you get home, have an early dinner, have a small early dinner, and you're done. That's it. And that classifies as intermittent fasting. But the problem is, it's not sexy. It doesn't sound as exciting. So there are women out there who have taken this intermittent fasting, the TRF model, to an extreme. They only eat for 4 hours a day. And then they don't eat the rest of the day. So, you take anything that's sound and well-balanced, and you just twist it. So now, that in itself is almost like a food disorder. People are so crazy about, they're so restrictive that, hey, I can't have lunch with you because, you know, oh my gosh, it's not time for me to eat yet.
It's not within the time frame, yeah.
And that to me is not sensible. The sensible approach is just cut it down a little bit, meaning don't eat so late at night. Dinner should be the smallest meal, bigger lunch, biggest breakfast. Data supports it. It supports it for diabetics. It supports it for everybody.
Yeah. It just, again, it gets back to, I just feel like we're making this so hard.
Yeah.
You know, and we're just trying to fit into some kind of category.
Right.
When really we should just be more conscious of what we're eating. So that's a good way for us to wrap up. You know, what is the bottom line? You know, three things that we should think about with food.
Yeah, so there's actually four.
Okay.
Which is self-principle, right? So self-principle is sleep. Get 7 to 9 hours. Very
okay.
Simple. An hour before you go to bed, don't look at any of your electronics. Just make that last hour kind of like a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do something to relax yourself, sit, read a book. I know there's still books that exist.
Right.
Paper. Right?
Yeah.
Read it. In fact, it's so funny. I'm getting rid of my Kindle to go back to buying books because I find that I get more pleasure from reading books.
From holding a book?
Yeah. There's something cool about that. So that's the S. Exercise is very simple. Make sure that you're trying to get activity every single day. If you want to get a pedometer, get your 10,000 steps in, go for it. If you want to get 45 minutes to an hour of stuff doing, go for it. You know, the 30-minute recommendation, look, that's a bare minimum. That shouldn't be a maximum. So at a minimum, you should be getting 30 minutes every day, but really go beyond that. But make it so you're active throughout the day. We weren't built to only exercise for 30 minutes and then sit there for 23
right.
and a half hours. So active. Love-wise, just have friends. Invest in relationships. Be nice to people. Express gratitude. Meditate for 1 minute a day and you will be a happier person. And food, eat mostly plants. If somebody differs with you, it's okay. Don't treat it like a religion. At the end of the day, we're all going to die. It's more important how we live and how we treat each other. That's it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and helping us navigate this crazy world of food. And I definitely appreciate the amount of effort you put into all of the research and all of the evidence. And again, you know, I know you don't like being called an expert, but we're happy to have you because we need somebody to turn to clarify some of this. And I'm hoping that the listeners today got some clarity and maybe some better understanding. And hopefully you'll come back and do this again someday.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right. There you go. Episode number 3. We will see you back again soon. Bye-bye.